This episode of Registry Matters is supported by our patrons. Your generosity makes what we do here possible, enabling outreach, research, and more. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 358. Of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up tonight? How are you?
Doing awesome. I managed to resolve my conflict and get a satisfactory alternate plan, and I was able to pop into the studio today and do some prep work.
Do you want to tell me how you organized getting out of it?
Sure. Well, I have a state rep that was doing a fundraiser, and I really enjoyed my access to state representatives. And I was going to be at that fundraiser that started at 2. But I finally told the rep, I said, well, here's the bottom line. You're really trying to raise money. You're not wanting to socialize with me. I'll give you the money. And does that excuse me? And I was told, yes, that excuses me.
Wow, that's kind of blunt, Larry.
So, because it ain't about just going and hanging out, eating the nice food. And this particular representative cooks very nice food, and they have a nice layout. But that's not what the food is there for. The food is to extract the money from you.
And you're going to give it up anyway.
I'm going to give it up anyway.
Now, look, I just have to ask this question because I think I know the answer. For this level of engagement, this isn't like you're the Koch brothers and you got to run something with 7 digits after it, right? This is a 3-digit, maybe a 4-digit number?
Not even a 4-digit. This is like a legislative house district. The goal for the fundraiser today is $5,000. Anything above that is considered a smashing success because it's a relatively poor district on top of that. And if 25 people give $200, you've got it.
Wow. That seems so like just small peanuts, but that's what it takes to do the work to get elected?
Well, she'll need to do many of those. Won't be the only one, but you're trying to position yourself for by the time the qualifying season for anybody that's going to primary you come March when they have to file. You want to have your bank account at a level that the person says, wow, I don't think I'm going to try to take on this race. This person's got 90,000. I've got 3,000.
Did you offer to build this person a ballroom in their backyard by chance?
No, that's taken care of in D.C.
All right. Well, please make sure you show your support by hitting like, subscribe, 5-star review on your favorite podcast app, etc. It makes a difference to us. It helps people find the show. And in return, we will keep delivering this content that you enjoy so very much. And should you be very generous, like the people listening tonight in the live stream on Discord, they have become patrons, and you can do that over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Sorry, I'm really like my brain is fried. So tell me what we're doing tonight, Larry.
Well, unfortunately, it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom again. I didn't hear anything from our sidekick. I think he might be off the air. I don't know.
Okay.
But we have great news from one of our supporters that resides in South Carolina, and that person will be joining us, and the name is Amy. And we have a belated report on an important case from the state of Florida, and thanks to the Narsal staff attorney writing a report for our newsletter, I became aware of this. I think it was released in mid-August, and here we are in October. And we have a second segment of that creation of yours, and it's about homeless PFRs or about to be homeless. Got some questions from the audience as well. And there's a person who wants us to talk about the Sentencing Commission's revisions. I just don't know enough about it to be intelligent, so I'm looking for an expert to come join us to talk about that. But we're not blowing off the listener. Just I don't think I can be informative enough with what I know.
Shall we go over to the good news? I don't have a good news sounder of any kind.
So, yeah, you do. You got that old news sounder from the old days we did the Narsal in Action calls.
All right. Well, let's bring Amy in. Amy, can you hear me okay? I know you're out there in the woods.
I can.
Okay, fantastic. You have good news. This is related to Registry, Texas, South Carolina, something along those lines. Can you connect those dots?
Sure, I can try. So my husband had an offense in 1997 in Texas. He moved to South Carolina in 2019, and he worked in North Carolina because we live close to the North Carolina line. So he ended up being registered in South Carolina because we live there, North Carolina because he worked there, and remaining on the Texas website. In 2022, we petitioned for South Carolina to remove him from the registry. And in 2023, we got a letter that they had granted it. We started in 2020 petitioning the state of Texas for what they call early termination of registration. And he went through all the process, has to get all these evaluations. And so he's had three of those since 2020. And we kept getting delayed, going back and forth. But finally, yesterday, we had it granted for him to be removed from the Texas registry. So now we have to work with North Carolina.
Very cool. Now, just for clarity, is he actively on the registry, or is he quote unquote just on the website in Texas?
He didn't have any obligation to register, but the attorneys, it shows how much people don't, you know about what happens with other states and everything. You know, they were like, well, I mean, he's not really, does he have to register there? Does he have to register here? Why are we doing that? And I was like, well, I mean, it really could be a technicality. We could have gotten in there. And she said, well, he does, you know, doesn't have to provide information. He just remains on. And I was afraid that that may happen, but he didn't have to provide any information to Texas. They were getting updated information from South Carolina when he registered there, but he just remained on the site and nothing was updated.
Interesting. Larry, do you have any questions?
However, the reason that we petitioned to do that was because jobs, so since 2020, he's applied for multiple jobs. And then when he, for South Carolina, he's been removed. But when they do a background check, they do it for like 7 to 10 years back. And it shows up clear because it was 28 years ago. And then when they run the registry, it always shows up for Texas and North Carolina, even though he doesn't have to provide, you know, any information, but it shows up. And so we couldn't get past that for a background check for jobs unless Texas removed him and now North Carolina.
Wow. Go ahead, Larry.
I was wondering, is it the holdup is with North Carolina? We're telling you that they can't remove him because he's listed in Texas. Is that correct?
That is correct. Because when he got removed from South Carolina, I sent that to North Carolina. North Carolina said that they could not remove him until Texas did, or we could petition the court after he had been on the North Carolina registry for 10 years from the first time he registered in their county. So he couldn't do that until 2029. He can't petition the court.
And the funny thing about that was, I think there was a case out of North Carolina where they only count the time you're reporting and registering there. So if he's been out of North Carolina, they would probably play that card and say, well, he hasn't really been registered the requisite 10 years here.
Yes, so, exactly.
Let's hope they don't play any additional games with you. I'm fearful, knowing how these bureaucracies work, that they will. And just out of curiosity, if you don't mind and you don't need to feel obligated, how much financially has this endeavor cost you between the two states and South Carolina and Texas and all the evaluations? How much money have you been separated from to try to get this accomplished?
So the attorney himself was $10,000. And he said that if he had known how long this was going to take and how bad it was going to be, he would have charged way more. And then every evaluation was $2,500. And then, you know, so we had made multiple trips to Texas, and then they would reset court because like they wanted an updated evaluation or something happened. And we actually flew into Texas Wednesday. And when we got there, I messaged and said, you know, we're here or whatever. And the attorney said, oh, well, they don't have a court reporter, so we can't do it. I was like, this is our last chance to come to Texas. Like, we spent money we don't have. And he was like, well, we can't do it without a court reporter. And so I was like, I've been watching court in Texas, and they got a substitute the other day. I'm going to need somebody to find me a substitute. So we could have potentially been continued. And the judge said at the very end when she granted it, she said, I had every intention of saying no when you came in today.
Now, what moved her from no to yes?
So the attorney said that she really didn't have much. It was politically, you know, that she really needed. So the way that Texas does it is the prosecutor's office, you know, says whether they agree with it or don't. And if they don't, then the judge, it's the judge's discretion. And the judge can either grant you a hearing or they can just deny the petition. But she granted the hearing, and the DA's office kept going over the fact that they were going line by line for the police report. And so they were going to put my husband on the stand. And that's what the attorney said, is they were going to really grill him with this police report, humiliate him again. And I said, look, it's been 28 years of humiliation, and I would like to not get thrown out of court. And I just don't think I can watch that. And so I said, you know, can I get up there and just tell what it's doing to us? And so the attorney said that was fine, but that she was going to do the same thing to me. And I was like, that's fine. And she did. She was very, very ugly when I was testifying. And so then the attorney, you know, went into the fact that, okay, the justice system, you know, we all say is that if the justice system is about rehabilitation and moving on, you know, he's had jobs, he's got a master's degree, two bachelor's degrees. Like, he's proven himself. He's worked in leadership and healthcare for the last 20 years. Like, no, you know, criminal history since then. Like, if that's what the justice system is all about, is the rehabilitation, what is stopping? And so the DA's point of view was he got a benefit because he could have been charged if he hadn't taken a plea deal. And he had 5 years deferred adjudication, which is probation. And so she says that he got a benefit because he didn't go to jail. So he knew he was going to have to register for life because that was the law. So, you know, he got his benefit. The state of Texas didn't owe him anything else. And so the attorney said in 1997, there was no way to petition off the registry. Lifetime was all that there was. And if he had been charged with what you're saying, he would have only had to register for 10 years and could have been off a long time ago. So the judge, she said she had every intention of saying no, but that, you know, if she was going to stand up and say that the justice system was about rehabilitation, she couldn't really not say yes because of everything he had done.
That is really fabulous because, you know, you're in a relatively progressive part of the state over in Harris County, and they were taking a pretty hard-nosed attitude at the district attorney's office, the prosecutor was. But you were still able to overcome that with his exemplary record. So just know that you got lucky, but also he did a lot of work to earn this. And,
well, and that's what I told him. I said, you know, like, we got up there and I was like, you know, he was like, you know, you said this and the attorney said this. And I was like, and that did happen. And she had every intention of saying no politically. I was like, but I really want you to look at what you've done the last 28 years. I was like, because if you hadn't done that, we couldn't get up and say all that stuff about you. I was like, so it's really about you. You just needed somebody else's voice to say it's okay. And I'll tell you, when we sat down in court and when they read out the charge and what we were there for, the people that were sitting out in the crowd that were waiting their turn for whatever, you could see they were shocked. Like, oh my gosh, how could somebody be asking to get off? And then, you know, I went up there, and then by the end, I really still thought she was going to say no because it went really horrible with the DA. And so when I sat back down and, you know, she said, you know, when you came in here today, I was going to say no. And I thought, oh my gosh. But when she said yes, they actually cheered. And then they were meeting us out in the hallway. You know, they were crying with us and they were congratulating us. And it was just completely opposite of what you would think would happen.
Well, congratulations to you and to your family.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for sharing that.
We wouldn't have been able to do all that if I hadn't been listening to this podcast and had Larry beat it in my head that it's a website. And so I kind of started to change my mind about things and look at things different ways, you know, and I would say things and then Larry, you'd be like, yeah, but that's not, you know, that's not how they look at it. That's not like, and so I really do appreciate you guys and everything that y'all do because I've learned a lot and I believe that has helped me, you know, help us.
Well, thank you so much. And for everybody out there, there was no scripting. This was very much impromptu.
Yeah, like 10 minutes ago.
So that was really
nice. Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate you taking time away from s'mores because s'mores sounds really yummy.
It is, and I'm going now, so I'll catch you guys next time.
Take care, Amy. Have a great night.
I'll see. Bye-bye.
And Larry, people say you're all doom and gloom, and there you go. You help somebody make moves, make things better for themselves.
Well, it does. Accidents happen. What is that? The broken clock is
right twice a day, right? Yeah, and we just changed clocks. So if you were a person that doesn't change your clocks, daylight savings, we're back at standard time, I guess. Then your clock is back to normal.
So, alrighty. Well, all right. We've got this great question. I really like it.
Okay, so this is a good evening, gentlemen. I appreciate your work helping others. I have a question, and I was hoping to get your opinions. Probably not mine. An RSO completes their 15-year registration requirements in the state they live in for a CP-type offense. Not on any type of probation or parole. They are no longer an RSO, nor required to provide any information to the state regarding the offense. The person now wants to permanently move to a different state. If the new state you are moving to considers the same past offense, which had a 15-year requirement in the original state, a lifetime requirement, can the new state require registering in that state for life? Also, the person has never lived or registered temporarily in the new state. My thoughts are no, they are not an RSO. The states all seem to have very different rules, and I do not want to get caught up in something.
Something. What could that be? Something.
I would imagine that would be you call the Alabama registry people and go, hey, look, my crime was like 150 years ago. Do I have to register? And they go, you should come right down here right now.
So the answer to his question is very simple. The state that had the 15-year requirement, that is not binding on any other state. But having said that, since I'm not a lawyer and I don't have to worry about losing my law license or having any discipline imposed upon me, if you have been dutifully removed, 15 years sounds like it could be Arkansas, because that's how long you have to serve before you can petition under Arkansas's process. But if it was a petition process, that means that there was a court order. Always have that court order, multiple copies of it available in your vehicle, on your phone, however you believe in having it available, because it's not impossible that you could run into problems in another state. If I had been dutifully removed from registration by either court order or a letter saying I no longer had to register, I would go on with my life. And if I wanted to move, I would move. But I would have a backup plan in case it backfired. And that backfiring could be that the new state discovers you. And under their definition of a PFR, you are covered. Because in Alabama, if you went there, for example, if you're still alive, you're within the grasp of their registry because it has ever been convicted as the language, I do believe. And so therefore, you may end up with a legal requirement to register if you go to a new state. But that wouldn't stop me if I was determined to go someplace. I would just move on with my life. I'd have my court order. If I had court and encountered a law enforcement officer, I'd say, well, I got this thing here, right here in my glove compartment. Officer, can I open my glove compartment for you? I've got a court order with me that says I no longer have to register. yeah, you found that old conviction from 1994, but I've been released by a judge. Now, we are still in the United States, aren't we? The cops are going to say, yeah. I say, well, this court order, it would be kind of like a divorce decree. If I got divorced and I went to a new state, I wouldn't have to get divorced again. I essentially got divorced from the registry. Do I have to go to court again in this state? And the officer's going to shake his head, have no idea what you're talking about, be flabbergasted you're running around with a court order in your glove compartment, and he's going to call command. And command is going to say, get his information. We'll deal with this later. We'll send it to our legal people. They may come out and see you a week, 10 days later, tell you, well, we've researched it and you have to register. That's where your backup plan comes in. Do you want to register or do you want to hightail it back to where you don't have to register?
You would still have an angle to fight it at that point that you were removed. And doesn't that, the argument would then go back to it's a civil regulatory scheme, so you're not being quote unquote punished, right?
Yes, if the person, if they want to interject that into it, if he didn't say he had gobs of money and was willing to spend it. But you could argue those types of, I could come up with a list of things to argue. For example, the full faith and credit clause, you know, that I would put forward. He has the right to be treated like any other citizen. But if he spends all that money and the court doesn't agree with him, they say, well, it's black letter law. It says you are a person, aren't you? You remember Nebraska?
I do.
You do have a conviction in Arkansas, don't you? Yes. Well, our law says that if you have ever been convicted, you're required to register here. Are you registered here? Well, no, but I've been removed. But yeah, that was done in Arkansas, not here. So you've got to, we don't even have a removal process here, for example. Like in Alabama, I'm not aware that they even have a removal process. So therefore, you would spend a whole bunch of money. If that is your backup plan to spend a whole bunch of money, then I would go with it.
Very well. Shall we move along then?
I suppose so. What do we got next?
You people, you want to talk about this case from Florida regarding compelled speech. Didn't we already talk about this a few months ago, or are you seriously that senile and you don't even remember it?
No, we did talk about it on episode 329 back in January, but that was then. And
I thought it sounded familiar. So I read the case earlier today while I was on the public transportation going to a conference thing, a trade show. And then when I got home, I had to bathe the dog.
And did you read it again when you were bathing the dog?
Yes, I put it in a laminated thing so it wouldn't get all wet. And so that's what I did. But let's go moving along with the case, if we may.
Well, I don't know. You don't have a tub large enough to bathe their dog in the tub. I saw your dog. That dog is bigger than I am. Two of me.
Yeah, we need a small pool. We need like a kiddie pool that's about 4 feet deep for this dog. So let's get moving along. My recollection is that the Fifth District Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the offender's challenge, and I guess that means that the challenge would have been no markings, and the judge said that's correct, no markings?
That is correct. They did. If you recall, FYP predicted that the state of Florida would seek an on-bank review, and that term means a review by the full court. They got that review, and the full court sitting on-bank overturned the three-judge panel. Now, it came up as I was reading the decision that actually they decided sua sponte to review it. It was not a request by Florida. But anyway, there was an on-bank review.
Let's bring everyone up to speed that hasn't listened to 329. Florida law prohibits Christ from possessing a driver's license upon which the nasty predator marking is not displayed. Christ stands convicted of violating this latter statute, and he urged the court to overturn his conviction on the grounds that his marked driver's license compels him to speak in violation of the First Amendment. How did I do there?
Fantastic. Can I go home now?
Yeah, you go right ahead. I will finish this all up. Now stop bellyaching, and we'll keep moving through this. The facts of the case are undisputed. By virtue of his criminal history, Christ is a sexual predator. According to the court, after his 2008 release from prison, Crist resided in Sumter County and began serving 17 years of supervised release. The Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles issued him a driver's license bearing the required nasty, nasty markings. During a registration check in 2019, a law enforcement officer asked Crist to present his identification. Now, do you think that's normal during a PFR check?
I've heard that it's fairly normal, but I refused when I was registered, and they did.
Did you really?
They did, and they did not think I was very funny.
If you refused, did they like cuff up now or something? What'd they do?
No, what they did. When I remember, I work in a law office, so I had a little bit of an advantage over them. So they said, "Well, if you don't show your ID, be cooperative with us, we'll call your PO and have them pause your house." And I said, "Well, I'm glad you let me know that." I said, "Let me call my attorney, and I'll have him here while you're tossing." And the PO never showed up. And all I heard about it once I got to the next time I saw the PO, I heard that I was not very nice to the sheriff's deputy. And I said, "That is correct." I said, I told him specifically what I intended to tell them. I told them when they asked me my name, I told them my name. They said, "Can we see ID?" And I said, "No." I said, "You're on my property." And they said, "Well, how do we know you're you?" And I said, "Well, bring a picture next time." And they did not think that was funny.
Now, remind me, were you on supervision or not supervision?
Yes, I was under supervision at the time.
Hold on. Wouldn't you not have your Fourth Amendment like protections wouldn't you have to produce it?
It wasn't the PO, it was the sheriff's.
And that makes a huge difference?
It makes a huge difference when law enforcement is acting not as a probation supervising officer. If they come to your door, I can't speak for all states, but in this state, you have every bit the same privacy rights you have as a regular citizen. If the probation officer knocks at your door, you do not have the same privacy rights. But I don't have to let the cops in my door just because I'm on probation.
You've got big, big, I won't finish that sentence. So, Crist removed his driver's license from his wallet, hesitated, and appeared to pick at it with his fingers. Based on his prior experience, the officer suspected that Crist was removing a sticker covering his predator designation. The officer demanded that he immediately stop picking at the license and surrender it. When Crist continued to hesitate, the officer grasped the license and confirmed his suspicions. It bore a smiley face emoji sticker covering the designation.
You've got to admit that that's funny.
I actually do think that's kind of funny that he put a sticker over it. The court stated, like at least seven other states, and like the federal government does with U.S. passports, Florida requires a special marking appear on the driver's license and identification cards that the state issues to persons with a history of certain PFR-type offenses. For sexual predators, the licenses and cards must bear the marking sexual predator. Now, what is a predator versus an offender?
Well, I don't know precisely, but according to the definition, sexual predators are sexual offenders whose crimes involve A, repeated offenses, B, violence or crimes against minors. Well, and that's under Florida section 775.213A. And they're subject to enhanced public registration, public notification, and address verification checks. And that's also under that same section, 775.216, paragraph 6, 8, and 10. But I have heard from the Floridians, it's a very large percentage of the registered offender population. It's not minuscule. It is when you group those three things together, violence, crimes against minors, and repeat offenders, you've got a huge percentage of the PFR population.
The state then charged Crist with possessing a driver's license upon which the required marking was not displayed or had been altered, as well as with evidence tampering for attempting to remove the sticker. They stacked charges for sure. Come on. Okay. That's evidence tampering. Okay. That's a stretch, Larry.
They do that. They do that here. Evidence tampering is always filed with practically every charge. But Crist asked the trial court to declare the statute unconstitutional as applied to his prosecution. And that's the section that covers the marked licenses for sexual predators. He relied on an Alabama federal court decision and a recent Louisiana Supreme Court decision. Crist argued that the marked license requirement compels him to speak in violation of the First Amendment. The trial court denied the motion, and then he proceeded and pleaded no contest to the charge.
I think it is noteworthy that a divided panel reversed and that the full court decided on their own initiative to do the rehearing en banc. They decided on their own. I don't think, like, don't Supreme Courts not choose which cases they go hear? Like, someone has to go appeal to them?
Well, this is the Court of Appeals. This is merely the full number of judges sitting on that Fifth District Court of Appeals. And they divide up into panels. So this is actually the same court. It's just the full body. And I don't know how many judges total it is. But they can pick and choose. If they don't like something a panel has done, they can certainly reach down. And they don't do it very often. But in this case, this is big business. This would take a lot of people if this had been affirmed by them and this decision had been upheld. This would have wrecked a fair amount of the Florida registration process. We can't have that.
Clearly not. So federal district courts in Alabama and Louisiana, as well as the Louisiana Supreme Court, have accepted compelled speech claims, much like these Doe versus Marshall 357 Federal Supplemental 3rd 1310. I don't know all this stuff, Larry. Check the show notes for this stuff. And the court held that the marked identification requirement for registrants is government speech, but nonetheless unconstitutionally compels private speech. Now, why did the case of Doe 1 versus Marshall not prevail?
Well, because the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which is where Florida resides geographically, rejected a materially similar compelled speech claim against sex designations on driver's license in just 2024. The 11th Circuit held that any speech on a driver's license is government speech, and they gave examples like male and female designations do not compel license holders to communicate messages about their sex. In addition, a California federal district court rejected a compelled speech claim, much like Crist, when it upheld the identifier that federal law requires to appear on U.S. passports. And that case was Doe versus Carey back in 2016. The court concluded that the plaintiffs failed to state a claim because the sex identifier is government speech and does not compel the passport holder's speech.
Now, did you say what I think I heard you say?
What did you think you heard me say?
I guess something about some government speech and does not compel the passport holder's speech, something like that.
Yes, I did say that. I except it's actually the Fifth District Court of Appeals saying that. The misguided premature lawsuit initiated by a reckless California attorney has now come back to bite us in the arse.
Now, what is the standard of review in this type of situation? Are they bound by the three-judge panel?
They are not. Remember that this is one. This is the entire court acting as one group. So there's no precedential value. Now, but I know where you're going. If a three-judge panel had gotten a similar case and this previous decision that we talked about in January had been allowed to stand, normally a three-judge panel will not overrule a previous panel decision from that court, but the full court can't, and that's what they did. But the court noted that Crist raised an emergent issue that surfaced less than a decade ago and on which a few courts have reached, and they've split it. Only a few courts have reached a decision. They said, quote, because we face a matter of first impression within our district with no directly on point decision from either of our reviewing courts, we undertake our own analysis below. And because Chris asked us to opine on a matter of federal constitutional interpretation, we conduct that analysis de novo. And they cited Henry versus State, a 2015 Florida Supreme Court decision.
Remind me, de novo?
That means brand new without any deference whatsoever.
Okay. Clean slate then, huh?
Yes, they're not bound by anything that's been decided previous to it getting to them. It's a matter of first impression.
Well, then the court stated any reasonable observer will understand the message that Crist is a nasty PFR, just as is that he is licensed to drive in Florida, and just as it is with all the other information on the license. This is not cool, man. This is not good.
Well, you could say it that way, but if you look at the way they're looking at it, the state has not compelled Chris to speak publicly or disseminate its message. He can choose to not ever show his driver's license to anyone other than a police officer. There have been many federal and state decisions that have rejected compelled speech claims against PFR in a registration itself and reporting requirements. And unlike the driver's license, where the holder passively presents the license and the circumstances, the registries require the offenders to affirmatively and continuously update their document, their information on their address history, and that's put out for the public. They're being forced to speak, and those claims have been turned down. Many offenders have claimed that these requirements unconstitutionally compel them to speech, and the courts have repeatedly rejected that claim.
I figure you could find a way to rationalize a ridiculous ruling, and which you did, because you are Mr. Doom and Gloom. You are effectively impossible.
I agree with you entirely. That is why I am here.
So, well, I mean, the people in Florida, they select these judges to serve on their courts of appeals and their Supreme Court, and they want people that go by the text, and this is what they've got here. I mean, it's a classic textual interpretation. How can you complain?
I'm trying to think of how often I hand over my driver's license to do much, and it's really not that often, but maybe that's a privilege that I have that I don't have to do that very often. How often do you hand your driver's license over to anybody?
I can't think of handing it over to anybody except for when I go to the doctor. You do have to usually show it these days at these mega medical clinics.
If you're taking a plane somewhere, you're going to have to show your ID.
Well, I usually use my passport, but that might be marked too if I had a PFR mark, but I usually have my passport. But other than seeing the doctor, I can't think of when I show my identification to anybody. There's another situation when I buy my medication that New Mexico allows for medicinal use. I have to show it.
Of course, for the wacky weed. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, anything else here? I mean, is this what you expected to have happen?
No, not really. I was shocked. Well, I mean, I'm not surprised that they overturned it, but I was shocked how quickly they did it. This was only in January and in August they've already had briefing and they've already overturned it, and we didn't even know about it. FYP education, we're supposed to be on the cutting edge of reporting stuff.
You need to tighten up, man.
I know it. It's our researchers have not been doing their job. We're paying good money for this, and lo and behold, we missed something.
We did.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right. Well, then how about we cover this question real quick from one of our almost original patrons. And he asks, recently, a judge ordered the Trump administration to fully fund SNAP. Obviously, we're taking a huge detour from registry conversations, but we'll throw this in and figure out how to make it work, right? The judge ordered the Trump administration to fully fund SNAP benefits, even though they said the money for the full month was not in the contingency fund. If the judge can bypass separation of powers of Congress, which does the funding, Why can't this judge just bypass separation of powers and order the Democratic senators to vote to reopen the government?
Well, that is kind of a stretch, but I see where he's coming from. And the answer to the last part of the question is because of separation of powers. He cannot order, the courts can't order senators to vote to do anything. Yeah, we've learned that, haven't we? In all the different times that we've had PFR wins and the courts have given legislative officials chance to legislate.
Yeah.
And I said, that's great. You can suggest and urge them to legislate, but you can't require them to legislate. But if you want to get a little deeper into the weeds, this is quite an interesting dilemma because the funding for SNAP, since there was no continuing resolution voted on and approved prior to October 1st when the new fiscal year started, technically there is no authority for a SNAP program. There's authority, I should say, for a SNAP program. There's no authority for SNAP benefits to be distributed because no money has been allocated by the constitutional process that no money, public money, can be expended but for with an authorization of Congress. So therefore, there's no authority to spend money. Well, I, contrary to my progressive friends, I believe that the administration is correct without authority to spend money on SNAP. I just wish they'd be intellectually honest, not spend money on anything, because they're picking and choosing where they don't want to spend money. But without an authority to spend money, they should shut down everything that doesn't have authority. And that basically would shut down almost all of what government does. And let people find out what it's like to not have anything operating. But there is no authority without a continuing resolution. So therefore, I can understand that they're taking the position. That contingency fund is to backfill if they run short. When they appropriate X number of billions of dollars for SNAP, if they run over that, that's a contingency fund, the way I understand it, to make sure that the SNAP recipients receive their benefits. But it's not when they haven't funded anything for SNAP. So I come down leaning towards the administration on this one issue.
So we have one out of...
Well, I agree with them on the shower heads. That was a good decision.
Okay. All right. I'm done with you. Let's talk about an all too common situation for a lot of folks. When the rug gets pulled out from under you and suddenly you're facing a housing instability crisis. Larry, we had a conversation in our sphere written about potentially becoming homeless because their only current housing, a parent's place, might be going away because of their parents' declining health. Lots of emotions, but also many practical questions.
Yeah, that would be a very tough scenario for registrants. To begin with, housing can already be nearly impossible, and it can be almost impossible. And add to that losing your primary support like a parent, and you're looking at a really serious crisis. But I want to frame this up a little bit because it's not rare. If you're PFR, the deck is already stacked. Restrictions, social stigma, many times employment limitations, what you can't do. And then you add that with a major life event like a parent passing away or get sick, you go from barely stable to potentially being homeless and roaming around the streets almost immediately.
Now let's zoom out for a second. One of the top ideas on this was basically, I know how scary this is because it's happening to me too. What are the first things that someone should do, even while they're still under the roof, to prepare for the possibility of losing their housing?
Well, now, this is easy for me to say because I'm not in the position, but if you're trying to survive and go out and do day labor and keep some money coming in, do a DoorDash or whatever people do, but don't wait for that day to come. Even if you're not even sure that it's going to happen, you need to try to have a contingency plan. Take inventory of what you have in the way of resources, find out what the legal restrictions are in your state and county and local community. And unfortunately, some shelters are just straight up off limits to registrants, even if you've never had any issues. So you can't rely on shelter, emergency shelter, because you may be forbidden.
That's totally huge. And people outside the community might not get that. And for a lot of folks, the advice would be, well, go to a shelter, like you just said. But for PFRs, that can be illegal.
All right, and even if it's not illegal, they decline you like they do here. I was curious. I thought we had a progressive city, and I called around to a couple of the shelters here, and they do a PFR check. So it might not just be shelters. Some cities have ordinances that put entire swaths of the city of zip codes off limits. So start by checking your state registry laws, restrictions. And if you have a probation officer or parole officer, reach out to them. And yes, I know that everyone has a great PO, but they need to know that you're at risk for homeless. That way they can come out and arrest you before you get homeless and you'll have a place to stay.
And then you'll have a place to stay. It'd be awesome. And you'll get fed. You won't starve to death. It's perfect. That's a perfect solution there.
But it possibly can buy you some time or at least avoid new charges of failure to notify the PO if you're moving suddenly. But there was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in that, but that's exactly what they used to do here, because this guy, when I was in group therapy, they put a number up on the board and said, if you're stressed out, call this number anytime, day or night. And so the guys in the group, we were kind of had a good camaraderie going, and I said, well, whatever you do, do not call that damn number. And they said, what do you mean it's a help number? I said, yeah, it'll help you all right. It'll help you straighten into the jail cells, what it'll do. And this guy, he called it. He wanted to show us how we were wrong. And he called. He said he was traveling to his residence, and his issue was playgrounds with children. And he said that he just couldn't resist casting his eyes at the playground. And you don't need me to tell you what happened next within about an hour after he called the helpline.
Clearly. Well, how about we talk about money? Because the question of SSI or SSDI would often come up in this conversation. Do you have financial support? Are you applying for benefits? It can be a lifeline, can't it?
Yes, it can be a lifeline. And it's a tough process, but... absolutely, if you have a serious mental or physical disability, Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI, or Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, both use the same medical criteria. Now, we're not going to really dive into the weeds about what these programs do, but they both provide cash payments. They have the same medical requirements. But you, in order to qualify medically, you must have a mental or physical disability that limits your ability to work any job that exists in significant numbers in the national economy. And there was a comment that was saying, try, but know that almost they'll reject your initial application. I'd say it wouldn't be quite that strong. As the commenter said, you stand about a 30 to 40% chance of getting it if you have a well-documented mental or physical disability on the first application, but you're most likely going to have to file an appeal.
And so if we could call that a practical takeaway, if you are in any way disabled, start the application as soon as possible. You actually have a fair amount of expertise in this area, don't you?
I do. And I could help people if they're trying to navigate that system and encourage them to stay away from the big box law firms. But you don't need to be an expert. You don't even need to be a lawyer to represent Social Security claimants. But you could actually do it yourself, but I don't advise it as most of everything else. But collect the medical records and even consider getting medical records from the jail if you think they'll be helpful. And anything that shows that you're struggling with physical or mental barriers that that render it difficult for you to remain employed.
All right, well then let's move on to something a little bit more high stakes. If someone is on the brink, what are some other forms of support? Now, we're talking beyond government cash or community, maybe faith groups, friends, or family. How do you even start the conversation? Be like, hey, uncle, can I borrow a Benjamin? I'm about to get kicked out.
Well, it is a little awkward, but reach out and be honest within your limits. You don't have to open the conversation with, I'm a PFR. Just, I'm losing my place, my home. I'm trying to make a plan. Do you have any leads? Do you know anyone that has renting a room out? sometimes talking to people in recovery communities or supported church groups can open the door. The key, I would say, is to seek that help before you're out on the street. It's amazing how once you're out on the street and your physical appearance and your mental health deteriorates, people don't want you. Have you noticed that when you encounter a person that's been homeless for a while, no one wants to be around them? Have you observed that?
Totally. Yep. And then if we could possibly, if we can double back to the highest, harshest scenario, if you literally have nowhere, zero options, what does the law say? Like, for example, if someone is forced to register as quote unquote homeless, how does that typically get handled?
Oh boy, it varies, but in many states, you'll have to check in more frequently than a person who has stable housing. Sometimes it's even daily, but fairly common, it's weekly and monthly. But even if this is easy to say when you're not homeless because you're carrying all your belongings in a backpack or a shopping cart, but try to document everything, keep a log of when and where you are sleeping, and keep proof that you're checking in as best you can, that you're checking in with those requirements. And I've even heard that some places let you use general delivery addresses from the post office for mail.
What is general delivery?
It's like in the days of where there was not home delivery and you would pick it up at the general store. So a shopkeeper that was running a store might have a post office in the back of the store and the mail would be the general delivery. But if you go to any post office in any city, they have at least one facility that generally takes mail address general delivery Albuquerque. It may be, it's probably the downtown main post office here, but there's a place where you can get general delivery mail.
And, hold on, man. When did they not deliver mail to people's houses?
Well, I helped organize the home delivery back in the late 1800s.
It's like, wait a minute. I'm not that young, but come on, man. I don't ever remember the mailman never, like, not driving up to my house.
Well, but you didn't probably live in really rural areas. There's been parts of the country where I've even lived where we got in the back of a store, Paul Lamb's General Merchandise store in Inman, Georgia. We got, that was where the post office was. Everybody picked up the mail up at Paul Lamb's store. And then they have rural routes where the delivery, where your post office, your mailbox may be a mile from your house. I lived in Fayette County back when it was rural. And our post office was about 1 mile from where we lived because the rural route carrier just went down the main dirt road and left people's mail in those boxes.
On horseback, no less, right?
No, I think they had motorized vehicles back when I was living in Fayette County. So
crank on the front of it.
But building rapport with your registration officer can possibly save you grief. And if you don't have that rapport, you're vulnerable to being accused of noncompliance very quickly. If they don't like you, they're looking for a way to violate you.
I'm trying to imagine, if you are homeless, you possibly can't charge your phone for you to tell them where you are, which on foot, I mean, you could only be a handful of miles away from where the probation office is for you to actually like ping them in person. Like that would be really hard. All right. I have a checklist of what to do if you might become homeless. Are you ready?
I am ready, but it's very difficult because if you're homeless, you generally don't have transportation resources.
You can't be a mile or two away. Like, that's about it.
And so a lot of PFRs choose to live in rural areas. I mean, we got one in Georgia that went down from urbanized New York to the most sparsely populated county in Georgia, and that's where he lives. And if he didn't have transportation, how would he get anywhere?
Right. All right, so number one, notify your PO. Start looking at eligibility for SSI or SSDI. Identify all of the places that you can sleep legally. Talk to everyone, neighbors, faith groups, extended family, about potential places, even if it's just temporarily. But God, then you'd have to go register all of those addresses too. And then document everything.
Well, you've covered it. But like I say, these are challenging suggestions because if you're truly homeless, all these things are much more difficult. And one more, if your crisis is tied to a relative's health, start those conversations as soon as possible. If your dad is sick, ask him for paperwork that you might need. mail with his address, a note to your PO explaining the situation, anything showing your connection to the address. In a perfect world, he could even talk to a lawyer about arrangements, but most people, if you're going to be homeless, not in the perfect world where they can talk to a lawyer, because the lawyer's not going to work pro bono most of the time.
And since you are the legal guru, most people assume lawyers are criminals. Sorry, lawyers are for criminals or for rich people. But if you're about to lose housing, are there resources that the legal profession can help out with?
Possibly. I don't want to be strong to say absolutely. Legal aid organizations exist, I think, in almost every state. And some supposedly specialize in housing or reentry, but they can't perform miracles themselves. But they might be able to help you negotiate with landlords or with a shelter or a service provider. Having been a landlord, if I got a call from legal aid, it probably wouldn't have a much impact. But I might consider, if they could make a cogent argument, I might want to consider the special circumstances. So it can't hurt. If nothing else, they at least know the lay of the land locally.
Does anything else come to mind in that regard?
Well, sure. Don't give up, because it's going to feel impossible. But more importantly, don't try to hide. Let the authorities know that you're trying your best to be compliant. And that's way better than just dropping off the radar. And remember, if one application gets rejected for SSI or SSDI or shelter or anything, appeal the denial or apply again. And people in support groups are right. Persistence is half the battle.
Well said. And if any of this connects for you, reach out early, stay organized, and don't get lost in shame or isolation. God, this community, the PFR community can be a lifeline. I guess another thing, possibly try to reach out to your local, if you have an affiliate, if you have anybody that helps work with the PFR types, maybe they can offer something of a place you can go.
I would say that's
thanks
a good
for the
idea.
Wisdom, sir.
I said that's a good idea. I didn't even think of that, because I know Restore Georgia is sitting on about $1 million in the bank, and they definitely.
Totally. We could put you up in a, a 5-star hotel for a month.
So, all right. Glad I could be of help. If you're facing a crisis, don't face it alone.
Very good. Do you have anything else? We are approaching a 1 hour.
I think we had a great episode.
I think so too, especially the great news from Amy. So you can also get off the website in another state to help you. Is it absolutely replicatable what she did?
I don't know. It probably is, but look at what she spent, $50,000.
Jesus, that's a lot of dough, dude. That is a lot of, and it's not that attorneys are for criminals and rich people. Attorneys are criminals.
No, don't go that far.
Head over to registrymatters.co for show notes, and you can leave us email, send us email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com, which is how we got that other question. I forwarded that on to the Larianator. You could leave us old-fashioned voicemail at 747-227-4477. And if you would be so kind and generous, please head over to patreon.com/registrymatters and support this program. Very much appreciated. Have a great night, sir. Talk to you soon.
Good night. I'll call you at 5 in the morning.
Don't do that.
You've been listening to FYP.